Well, this morning we find ourselves starting Matthew chapter 7. Matthew 7. So, let's read. Do not judge so that you will not be judged. Now, let's stop right there. The commandment is not to judge. Because what you're going to find out as we go through this chapter, you've got to judge between a dog and a pig. You've got to judge between wolves and sheep, between false prophets and true. And already in chapters 5 and 6, we see Yeshua teach us to judge who are hypocrites and who are not. Who's an adulterous woman and who is not. Who's wise and who is foolish. We judge all the time. What the verse is saying here, I think, is well put in John 7:24, where the Master says, do not judge by appearances, but judge with right judgment. You must always be judging. This does not mean condemning. It means weighing. You must always be weighing things. Because he says a little bit later in the chapter about false prophets, says, by their fruit you will know them. Well, unless you become a judge of fruit, you're going to be deceived by a false prophet. So let's make sure what he's saying here. He's not saying never make a verdict about somebody in your mind. He's saying what you have to do is when you do make a judgment call about somebody, you have to realize you have to make the same judgment call about yourself. You have to examine yourself. And that's what he's saying as we go on. For with the judgment that you judge, you will be judged. And with the measure that you use to measure, it will be measured to you. Why is it that you see the speck in the eye of your brother, but the log that is in your own eye, you do not notice? And Yeshua did not come up with this statement. This is a quote that was very well known during the day. It's a very good one. How can you say to your brother, permit me and I will remove the speck from your eye when the log is in your own? Hypocrite. Remove first the log from your eye, and afterward you will surely see to remove the speck from the eye of your brother. One of the things we have to realize is that all of us have character flaws, but with every character flaw you and I have, along with that is a misperception about ourselves. Let me say that again. Every character flaw you and I have is accompanied by its very own misperception of ourselves. Is that clear? In other words, you don't see your own character flaws. But guess what? I do. So does everyone sitting around you. I see what a messed up lot you all are, but I love you anyway. Because along with this, there's something else. The moment you can begin to see a character flaw in yourself, that is a signal from God that it's time for you to deal with it. The moment you begin to see your own character flaws, it's a signal from God, it's time for you to deal with it. And if it's time, he's given you the ability to do so. And what I love about you folks is not the fact that you're perfect, but I see you all working on your souls. I see you improving. I see you taking charge of things in your lives and saying, this has got to go. And you chuck it out. Or this needs to be built in. You begin to build it in. This habit needs to change, and you change it. I watch this. I'm just amazed. You inspire me. But the character flaws you're not aware of yet, well, then just give it time, and they'll become obvious, and then it'll be time to work on them. Okay? So, and there we are. We're back again. Okay. Now, we're going to be revisiting this passage over the next several weeks as we go through chapter 7. Well, let's go to verse 6, and this is where we're going to camp out for today. Verse 6, do not give the Kodesh to the dogs. Kodesh is the word for holy. The Kodesh, HaKodesh, to the dogs. And do not throw your pearls before the pigs, or else they will trample them with their feet and then turn and tear you apart. So today we're going to talk about dogs and pigs. And I've heard all kinds of explanations about what the holy is, what the dog is, what the pearls are, what the pig is. Some translations say, well, the dogs refer to the Gentiles. But they never explain what the holy is. And the pig, some commentaries say, well, it refers to the Romans. Because there's some notion, and maybe it's true, that the Roman legion that was in Israel at the time, its emblem was a pig. So maybe it was. And then, but what are the pearls? What does it mean to throw your pearls before swine? Who would even think of doing such a thing? I think there's something much deeper going on here. And I think also the scriptures themselves give us the hints as to what these deeper things are. So we can understand that there are two kinds of people that we deal with that we shouldn't. At least we shouldn't give the holy to the one and the pearls to the other. But we also need to understand what the holy is and what the pearls are. And to do this, we have to have wise judgment. We have to have discernment so we know who we're spending time with. So let's start with a dog, and let's start, first of all, with the holy. What is the holy? Well, any Jew who's reading this passage can tell you immediately what it is. Well, the holy is holy meat. Because in Exodus 29 and throughout the Torah, it talks about the sacrifices that are put on the altar. And it says that whatever touches the altar, whatever meat is put on the altar, it becomes holy. Whatever touches the altar shall become kodesh or kadosh, holy. And of course, holy meat is to be eaten by the priest and by the one who brings the sacrifice. It's shared. Part goes in the altar, is burnt up and goes to God. Part is given to the priest. The rest is eaten by the one who offers the sacrifice and by his friends and family. They can eat it that day. They can eat it the next day. But the third day has to be burned in fire. You can't eat it on the third day. Because it's holy. This meat is called holy. It's kadosh. But when it comes to unclean meat, Exodus 22:31 says, "You shall be holy people to me, therefore you shall not eat any flesh that is torn by beast in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs." So Yeshua is quoting both of these. He's saying, don't take the holy flesh that's put on the altar and then throw it to the dogs like it's something unclean. So now we refine our question. Which T-bone is holy and which one is not? What is holy meat and what is unholy meat? What is the meat that we can throw to the dog and what is the meat that cannot be thrown to the dog? You might call a scientist in and tell this scientist, okay, now one of these cuts of meat here is holy, the other is not. I would like you to figure out which one is holy and which one is not holy. So the scientist, he takes samples of each one, puts it under his microscope. He does chemical tests. He does all kinds of tests and experiments and everything else. He comes back and says, there's absolutely no difference between these two pieces of meat. Absolutely none whatsoever. And yet one of them is holy and one of them is unholy. What is the thing that makes the one holy and makes the other not? What makes one piece of meat one that we can throw to the dog if we wish, but the other one, if we throw it to the dog, it's sin? And Yeshua says, do not throw the holy to the dogs. What is it that makes the difference? It's not something physical. It's not something tangible. You know, the first place that we find the word holy is in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 3, where it says that God sanctified the seventh day and made it holy. Because on it, God rested from all his work and was refreshed. So what made the seventh day holy? God said it was. God took ownership of that day. He says, it's my day. Don't misuse it. Now, you might call in Mr. Scientist again and say, okay, the Bible says the seventh day is holy. I want you to do studies to figure out what's different about this day. So the scientist takes months and he studies the seventh day. He studies the sun, the moon, and the stars on the seventh day. Doesn't see any difference in how they operate. He gets out his compass and notices the sun still rises in the east, sets in the west. He knows that the length of the day is no different. He checks weather patterns going back centuries, finds out the weather patterns don't all of a sudden change on the seventh day. Then he goes to the animal kingdom. Do the animals behave differently on the seventh day? And nope. The squirrels still do the same thing on the seventh day they did the other six. So do the birds and the horses, the dogs, the cats, and everything else. And finally, after months of study, he comes back and says, there's not one single thing different about the seventh day from the other six. Not one single thing different. So what makes it different? God says it is. He says it's his. So the question is, which one is holy? What makes it that way? The thing that makes something holy is that God owns it. And a dog is a person who does not recognize God's ownership of something. If you do not recognize God's ownership of something, in that area at least of your life, you're a dog. You're dog-minded. Because you put a piece of meat that's not holy and a piece of meat that is holy in front of a dog, he's just going to eat whichever one's closest. To him, they're both just meat. Now, God calls some things holy because he takes ownership of them. He created them, so they belong to him. He redeemed them, and they belong to him. But we also can give God ownership of things. We too have the power to take something and make it holy. See, the word kadosh simply means set apart. Set apart. When a young man asks a young woman to marry him and she says yes, she enters a period called kadoshim in Hebrew. Holy, set apart. That means if another man comes along and wants to ask her out, she says no. If another man wants to marry her, she says, get out of here. I am already set apart for someone else. Does she look any different the day after than she did the day before? Nope. It's just that she has verbally promised ownership of herself to someone else. And so she behaves differently. And then she waits for her bridegroom to come, and then for the marriage and the wedding feast. So, we can give things to God. We can set things apart to him to make them holy. But there are other things he's already set apart to himself. But what makes something holy, what makes it set apart to God, is that God becomes its owner. And a dog does not recognize God's ownership of anything. Do you recognize God's ownership of what belongs to him? We're a kingdom of priests, aren't we? Leviticus 10:10 says, you are to distinguish between the holy and the common, and between the unclean and the clean. Can you tell the difference? To know what is holy, you have to know what God says about it. To know what is holy, you have to know its history. You have to know what words have been spoken over it. You have to know what the intention is behind that thing. And if you're unaware of these things, you will not know what is holy and what is not. No, when I was up here doing the second part of the prayer service, I just knew that we're going to be reading Matthew 15. We're just reading a chapter from the Gospels each week. And so Matthew 15 came up. I had no idea what was in it. I guess if I'd stopped to think about it, I could have remembered some things. But I read it, and we came to the story of the Syrophoenician lady. And I thought, well, this is amazing, because I plan to talk about her. Well, I want to look at the account that's in Mark. If you want to turn to Mark chapter 7 for a moment. Mark chapter 7, because with this discussion of ownership and holiness, I think the story of the Syrophoenician lady will take on a whole new meaning to you. Syrophoenicia is outside of Israel. And Yeshua is traveling, and he's in an area where this Syrophoenician lady, this Gentile woman, comes. She's calling out to him. And Mark 7, verse 26 says, "Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." Now, what is being said here? Was he trying to put her down? No, he's trying to teach. He's trying to teach. She understood that outside of Israel, those are Gentiles, are referred to as dogs. And some people try to soften this, say, well, it really means puppies, puppy dogs. Maybe so. But he's saying there's bread that belongs to the children, and healing is the children's bread. And the children must eat first. And Yeshua had come only for the lost sheep of the children of Israel. He did not come for the Gentiles. Later, at his ascension, he would then tell his disciples, "Now go into all the world and make students, teaching them all the things I've commanded you." But until then, his mission was only to the lost sheep of the children of Israel. Those are the children. And he's going to take the children's bread and give it to the children. And healing was part of the children's bread. Now, what this woman does, she recognizes God's ownership. She recognizes that as a Gentile, she is not part of the covenant of Abraham. God established a blood covenant with Abraham, where God says, "I'm going to take care of you, Abraham, and your children forever. When you die, I'll still take care of them. I'll be their shield. I'll be their God, and I will protect them, and I'll feed them, and I'll put my name upon them. I'll give my land to them." And this woman realized she's outside of that covenant. She realized that she did not have a right to the children's bread. So what does she answer to Yeshua? But she answered him, "Yes, Master. Yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Because once the crumb falls on the floor, you don't pick it up and give it back to the child. Once it hits the floor, then the dogs can have it. Then what does he say? Verse 29, he said to her, "For this statement, you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter." Isn't that interesting? What's so amazing about that statement? Yeshua is realizing that she recognizes God's ownership. She recognizes what is holy and what is unholy, what God owns and what he doesn't, what belongs to him and what doesn't belong to him, what belongs to her and what doesn't belong to her. And because she saw God's ownership, though she may have been a Gentile, she was not a dog-minded person. She recognized the holy from the unholy. And because of this statement, he says, "You go your way. The demons left your daughter." And she went home and found the child lying in bed, the demon gone. It's a powerful picture. Being able to see what belongs to God and what doesn't is an important thing for us. You know, I saw that the first time the word holy is used in Genesis is in chapter 2, verse 3. It is applied to the Sabbath day. So I thought, well, how about the other books of the Torah? What's the first place in Exodus? The first place the word Kodesh is used in Exodus is in chapter 3, verse 50. It's where, it should be verse 5, not 50. I think I hit the zero instead of the parentheses there. So that should be a parentheses. Chapter 3, verse 5. This is when Moses sees the burning bush and he approaches it. And God says, "Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." The place upon which you are standing, the place is holy. So we see now space. Why is it holy? Because God made the earth. It belongs to him. The world is his and all that's in it. In Leviticus, the first place that holy is used is in chapter 2, verse 3. "But the rest of the grain offering shall be for Aaron and his sons. It is holy of holies." It's most holy. Part of the Lord's food offerings. Now we see matter. We see things that are proclaimed holy. Because when these sacrifices are given to God, they belong to him. They're holy. They're set apart. In Numbers, chapter 3, verse 13, the first place holy is used in the book of Numbers. "For all the firstborn are mine. God says. On the day that I struck down all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, I made holy, I consecrated, I sanctified, I set apart for myself all the firstborn of Israel, both of man and of beast. They shall be mine. I am Adonai. So now we see people set apart for God. Now this is interesting. God's the one who created time. When he set the stars and the moon and the planets all in motion, that is how we measure time. It's for signs, for moedim, okay? So God created time, it belongs to him. But he blessed the seventh day, said, this one's mine. And we know that Yeshua is the master of the Sabbath. He can tell us exactly how to set this day apart and honor it. But also, the whole world is his. All of space is God's. He made it. He created the earth. It belongs to him. You make it, you own it. And then matter, especially the sacrifices they're given to God, they're not only holy, they're holy of holies. Because it all belonged to him to start with, but when you take it and you have authority over it and you give it back to him anyway, now it becomes holy of holies. And then in Numbers, he says, when I killed the firstborn of Egypt and I took you out, redeemed you, now you firstborn of man and beast, you belong to me. You are set apart and holy to me. Now in Deuteronomy, the first time you find the word Kodesh is just a proper name. It's a name of a place. I wasn't quite sure how to analyze that. But driving in here this morning, I think I got it figured out. And I think here you can put the word spirit. Because at Kodesh is where the Israelites spent 19 years. Now they were in the wilderness for 40. They wandered the wilderness for 38 years. Okay? Half of that time they spent in one place called Kadesh. And during that time is when so many of the old ones died and the young ones were born. It's a place where God says, I own the new life, life itself, the very spirit of the people. I am changing the very nature of this people. The people I redeemed out of Egypt were not worthy to go in the promised land. But during this time, I'm making a change in the very hearts of these people to where this new generation will go into the land. So spirit, maybe life. And so this brings up something that is very timely. You know, in 3 weeks is Passover, 3 weeks from today. And Passover is when we celebrate a covenant meal. Passover is the day that God took full and complete ownership over the people of Israel. He says, before you belonged to Pharaoh, now you belong to me. Before you followed Pharaoh's rules, now you follow my rules. Before you lived in Pharaoh's land, but I'm going to take you to my land. Before there were all these Egyptian gods, I'm going to be your God. And through the blood and the body of the Lamb, he redeemed the people out of Egypt to be a people to himself. Right? And it's no coincidence. It was God's sovereign authority that caused him to orchestrate that Yeshua himself would be crucified on Passover. So the day before Passover, he tells his disciples, I have longed to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. So he led them in a Seder the day ahead. And he broke the bread, took the cup, and he said, do this, the Seder, in remembrance of me. You've been doing it every year of your lives in remembrance of what God did through Moses and through the Passover lamb for the people of Egypt to pass them from death to life, from slavery to freedom. But I now want you to look at this as the ultimate fulfillment, that I'm the one who passes you from death to life, from slavery to freedom. And everything that happened to the people of Israel through that Passover lamb and through Moses is all a picture of me and what I'm doing on this day. You belong to me. You do this Passover Seder in remembrance of me. And I know in the past we've read that passage, thought he's referring to communion. Communion did not exist at that time. In fact, communion is not in the Bible. A communion didn't come along for about another 3 centuries. It comes out of Roman Catholicism. And I'm not against communion. It's a beautiful man-made tradition. And it's something that very much reminds us of what Messiah accomplished. I'm not knocking communion. But I want to understand, this is not talking about communion. That didn't come along for centuries later. This is the Passover Seder. And now, look what Paul tells us. Over in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, let me start, though on here it starts with verse 27, let me start with verse 23. Paul says, "For what I received from the Master is just what I passed on to you, that the Master Yeshua, on the night he was betrayed, took bread, and after he had made the baraka, he broke it and said, 'This is my body, which is for you. Do this as a memorial to me.' Likewise also the cup after the meal." Because after the meal is when the third cup is taken. The third cup of the Passover Seder is called the cup of redemption. And the one right after the meal is this cup. And this is why he takes that third cup. And he says, "This cup is the new covenant affected by my blood. Do this as often as you drink it, as a memorial to me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the death of the Lord until he comes." And then look what he says in verse 27. Paul is talking, says, "Therefore, whoever eats the Master's bread and drinks the Master's cup," and we're having our Passover Seder in 3 weeks, right? "In an unworthy manner, will be guilty of desecrating the body and blood of the Master. So let a person examine himself first, and then he may eat of the bread and drink from the cup. For a person who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment upon himself." This is serious stuff. We love doing a Passover Seder. It's a time of great joy, great meaning, great food, great fellowship with family and friends. It's a wonderful time of year, one of the times we look forward to more than any other day. But we cannot allow ourselves to forget that we are celebrating a covenant meal. What's the covenant? That I don't belong to me anymore. I belong to God. He purchased me. He redeemed me. That's what it means to redeem. He bought me. I was bought with a price. I don't belong to me anymore. I'm holy. I'm set apart to him. And if I don't discern the fact that my body belongs to him, then there's a problem. Because when we say we belong to the kingdom of God, but we live like we're in the kingdom of darkness, if we say, "Yes, I'm holy to the Lord, I belong to him," and yet we act as if we belong to ourselves, there's a problem. And because we belong to God, he will spank his children. He will discipline them. And it says, "This is why many of you are weak, and worse than that, you're sick. And even worse than that, have died." If we would examine ourselves, we would not come under judgment. But when we are judged by the Master, we are being disciplined. What God owns, he takes care of. What God owns, he disciplines. What God owns, he changes. Or he prunes it away. So that we will not be condemned along with the world. So as we approach this covenant meal in 3 weeks, let's take it seriously. Let's discern what is holy. And if God says you are set apart to me, then let's live like it. Let's take the Sabbath day, for example. Let's just take an example. I could take anything, but we'll take the Sabbath day. It's a Sabbath, so it's a good day to talk about the Sabbath. And it doesn't apply to you because you're all here, right? Okay. Yeshua says, don't take what is holy, what belongs to God, and give it to people who do not recognize God's ownership. As generous as it is to the dog, don't give it to him. And God says, the Sabbath day is holy. Keep it holy, protect it. It's not a day for doing your thing. It's a day for you to come before me, that we spend together. We say, but Lord, my cousin is getting married. His bachelor party is Friday night. His feelings will be hurt if I don't attend. And God would ask you, does your cousin recognize my ownership of this day? Well, no. Then don't take what's holy and give it to your cousin, who doesn't recognize my ownership of this day. But Lord, there's this big walk-a-thon. We're raising money for a good cause. Do the people running the walk-a-thon recognize my ownership of this day? No, but it's such a good cause. Well, I appreciate your generosity, God says. But don't take what belongs to me and give it to people who do not recognize my ownership of it. Well, Lord, this organization I'm a part of, they're having this big event. Do the people running the organization recognize my ownership of this day? Well, no. Then don't take what's holy and belongs to me and give it to them. Do you get the idea? Do you understand? Tim, yes. Yes.
To invite someone who I've invited some friends before who know that they don't feel about it the same way I do, and have said, look, if you want to invite someone else who may take this more seriously, do that. And I'd say, no, I want you to share in this together. Well,
right.
It's one thing to do like you're explaining. It's maybe
that's an excellent question. And I knew it would be at this point in the teaching that everybody would have questions. And so, Tim, I appreciate you breaking the ice. So the question Tim is asking is, well, how about someone who doesn't know Torah, doesn't know about Passover, and you invite them to your Seder, does this apply? And you could ask this question about anything, the Sabbath day, or how do we apply this to people who just simply don't know? And I think the answer is, and it takes more wisdom than what I have, but I think the question is this: Am I going to awaken within them a recognition of who owns them, of who owns this day, of who owns this? Am I going to awaken holiness, a sense of holiness in them? Or is it just going to be a chance to eat a lot of good food and be entertained for an evening? I think that's how I would determine. And I know there are times we are called upon to violate the Sabbath day. A person's ox is in the ditch. Or in your case, it might be your Ford is in the ditch. You get out and you help them get it out. I mean, we have clear commandments about this. Yeshua healed on the Sabbath. And because he said, healing people is more important than getting oxen or Fords out of the ditch. So there are times when we violate the Sabbath, but we must use great discernment and wisdom in doing this and recognize who the day belongs to. Okay? It's very important. And as we approach Passover, let's recognize that this is a covenant meal where we celebrate the fact that we have been purchased by our Messiah, by our God. We belong to Him. We don't belong to us. But if you're living your life like you do belong to you, you have no business eating the Passover Seder. Otherwise, you might be inviting some weakness, even some sickness, even death. Because God takes us seriously, even if you don't. You follow? So, your giving of the holy things to people who do not appreciate them might be a great act of generosity and love. But God says, Messiah says, don't do it. Just don't do it. You know, you're all very familiar with the place where the Pharisees are testing Yeshua. And they say, is it proper to pay taxes to Caesar? Now they realize there's no good answer to this question. Well, they thought there wasn't until Yeshua gave them a perfect answer to it. So he says, show me a coin. They bring out a coin. And he asked, now listen how he asked the question. Whose image and likeness is on the coin? Now, as soon as he said those words, image and likeness, he only had said, whose picture is it? Whose image is it? He said, whose image and likeness? Immediately, they would have thought back to when God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. Okay? See, the coin's there. Whose image and likeness is this? Well, it's Caesar's. We'll give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. But give to God what belongs to God. In other words, where has God recorded his image and likeness in the world? In every one of us. So give Caesar the coin, but give yourself to God, because you bear his image and likeness. You follow? This is what holiness is, giving to God what he owns. Has he redeemed you? That means you're not your own. You're bought with a price. You belong to him. So quit saying you belong to him and then living like you belong to you. If a man will come after me, he must deny his right to himself. That's how that should be translated. Deny his right to himself. Because you see, when you don't give to God what belongs to him, that's called theft. When you take the Sabbath day and you use it the way you want, oh, I want to do some work on the Sabbath. I want to get some gardening done. I want to walk the walkathon or the big sale at the mall. You're stealing from God what belongs to him, and you're giving it to something else. Let's quit doing that. Let's be people of holiness. Let's model our Messiah. Well, you ready to talk about pigs? All right. Now, the dog, in the way Yeshua speaks, poses no danger to the person who gives him meat. But the pig does. He says, do not cast your pearls before swine, or they will trample them under their feet, and then turn, and they'll tear you apart. There's actually a passage in Psalms where it refers to pigs tearing things apart. It's in Psalm 80. It's referring to, well, let me just read part of it. Psalm 80, starting with verse 8. The psalmist is speaking to God and said, you brought a vine out of Egypt. Now, who's the vine he brought out of Egypt? That's the Israelites. He brought these 70 souls into Egypt, and they brought hundreds of thousands out. And then brought them to Israel where they continued to grow. You brought a vine out of Egypt. You drove out the nations and you planted it. You cleared the ground for it. It took deep root and filled the land. You see the picture, the imagery here of Israel, the people of Israel in their land? The mountains were covered with its shade, the mighty cedars with its branches. It sent out its branches to the sea, that's the Mediterranean, and it shoots to the river, that's the Jordan. Then the psalmist asks, verse 12, why then have you broken down its walls so that all who pass along the way pluck its fruit? Well, the answer is simple. They began to treat themselves like they did not belong to God. They began to treat the land as if it did not belong to God. They began to treat the Shemitah years and the Sabbaths like they did not belong to God. And then the next verse says, the pig from the forge tears it, ravages it, and all that move in the field feed on it. Isn't that interesting? So what are the pearls and what are the pigs? Well, you don't have to look very deeply into the word and into Jewish literature to realize that pearls represent the spoken words of wisdom. Spoken words of wisdom. The very essence and spirit of truth. There are many examples. I was looking at several in the Talmud and in the Midrash Rabbah where it talks about a person speaking pearls, speaking these pearls. And Proverbs as well says, blessed is the one who finds wisdom and the one who gets understanding. For the gain from her is better than gain from silver, and her profit better than gold. She is more precious than pearls, and nothing you desire can compare with her. Long life is in her right hand. Now remember, the right is the spiritual. And what is in her left? In her left hand are riches and honor. These are the physical things. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. She is a tree of life to those who lay hold of her. Those who hold her fast are called blessed. Now, do these words sound familiar to you? Where do you hear these each month? On Shabbat, when we, well, the Torah scroll is not there, but when the Torah scroll is lifted up, we point to it and say it is a tree of life to those who grasp it. All its supporters are praiseworthy. Let's talk about wisdom, because the very embodiment of wisdom is in the Torah. Paul tells us this, that in the Torah is the embodiment of wisdom and truth. The Torah itself is like a great pearl. And pearls in ancient times are worth much more than silver and gold. I think in modern times they're not worth as much. I don't know. But in ancient times, they were worth much more because getting a pearl was a very, very difficult business. You didn't have aqua lungs and deep sea divers and all of that. You held your breath, went down as deep as you could, and grabbed up an oyster and hoped for the best. And it was a very difficult business. But the very essence and nature of pearls are different from silver and gold. Silver and gold are not organic, but a pearl is something that's made by an animal, a creature. It's made in darkness, under pressure. Also, if you take an ounce of gold that's worth a certain amount of money, and you have this amount of gold, it's 1 ounce, and then over here you have a piece of gold that weighs 2 ounces, it's worth exactly twice what the 1 ounce piece of gold is. And then you have a 10-ounce ingot of gold. It's worth 10 times what the 1-ounce ingot is. Pearls don't work this way. You find a little pearl. It's worth a certain amount of money. Then you find another one's exactly twice the size. Guess what? It's not worth twice as much. It's worth 10 times as much. Then you find one twice that size. It's worth 100 times as much. Its worth is exponential. But then you take that ounce of gold that's worth a certain amount of money, you cut it in half. Each half is still worth half an ounce of gold. You take a pearl, cut it in half, it's worthless. You damage that pearl, you break it, cut it in half, cut it in fourths, it's now totally worthless. It's worth nothing. Zero, zilch, nada. In other words, you have the whole pearl or nothing. And the bigger it is, its growth, its worth is exponential. This is a picture of truth. Truth is something where if you just have a little bit of it, and like I always say, half a truth is a whole lie. Having a bit of truth, that could be a dangerous thing. Truth is something that is a whole unit. It's all of something. But it can grow. It can become more well-rounded. It can be more fuller. But half-truths are worthless. Absolutely worthless. And there's a lot of theology that is simply half-truths. It's got some facts, but it's not true. When Satan spoke to Adam and Eve, everything he spoke to them was factual because it was half-truths. But again, a half-truth is a whole lie. And I think it was just last week or the week before that I put the word emet, the Hebrew word for truth, on the overhead, spelled with the first letter of the alphabet, the middle letter, and the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Aleph, Mem, Tav. Covers the whole thing. This is truth. It's a whole unit. And we should be people who are speaking the whole truth with love. That's what we're to be. I could give you a lot of examples about pearls being pictures of truth, of wisdom, the essence of truth. Proverbs 8:11, for wisdom is better than pearls, and all that you may desire cannot compare with her. By the way, I came across this amazing insight. It's from the Midrash Rabbah. I've got to share a little bit of this with you. The word for pearl is the word panina, panina. By the way, there's a lady in the Bible whose name was Penina. That's your trivia question for the day. And maybe you can remember or figure out who that woman was. But in the Midrash Rabbah, it teaches that one who knows the Torah, the wisdom of the Torah, is more valuable in God's eyes than a high priest, even if that person is a mamzer. Now, Hebrew, mamzer is a Hebrew word for a very impolite English word, which you could say an illegitimate child. But an illegitimate child, a mamzer who knows the wisdom of Torah, in God's eyes is worth more. He takes precedence over a high priest. And they ask the question, well, how could this possibly be? And the answer is, it's homiletical. They look at the spelling of the word that's found there in Proverbs 8:11, where it says, for wisdom is better than pearls. Than pearls in Hebrew is one word. It's the word mipninim, mipninim. And the sages in ancient times said, this is a play on words, lifnei v'lifnim, which means the inner sanctuary. Now this is what the sages say thousands of years ago. And they're playing upon the Hebrew words, they're saying a person who knows the wisdom of the Torah has access to the inner sanctuary of the Holy of Holies. That's a powerful insight. That's an amazing thing. And of course, what is God looking for? He's building a bride for his son. And when you come to the very last chapter of Proverbs, Proverbs is all about wisdom, getting wisdom and understanding. Then you come to the last chapter. This is what everything in Proverbs is pointing to. Then ask the question, a woman of valor, the Ishet Chayel, who can find? She is far more precious than pearls. And you know, we read this on Friday evenings. Husbands read this to their wives, the woman of valor. But what is really being pictured here is God calling a bride to his son. And every verse is something that all of us must try to live up to. It's a spiritual picture. For example, on the way in here this morning, Robin and I were talking, and we haven't been talking about this, and she brought up the part here as you go down where it says, she is like a merchant's ships that brings her sustenance from afar. What does that mean? She's like a merchant's ships. What is the sustenance she has to go across the sea to get? Well, man does not live by bread alone, but by every word proceeds in the mouth of God. And it's saying that she's like a merchant ship. She knows where to go to the source of spiritual nourishment, and she brings it back to her household, for the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. You get the picture? You begin to understand why Yeshua later in Matthew will tell us again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls, who on finding one pearl of great value went and sold all that he had and bought it. Why would a man sell everything he has to buy one pearl? What could you do with this pearl? That's because everyone who heard this parable understood the pearl was the wisdom of truth, the wisdom and understanding of the Torah. There's a wonderful story in the Talmud about Rabbi Yochanan, who was a very revered, a brilliant, brilliant man, a holy man in the Talmud. And he had many disciples. One of his best known is Rabbi Chaya ben something or other. Abba, that's his, ben Abba, like Barabbas, Barabbas. And so they're walking along, and Rabbi Yochanan, he's not as young as he used to be. He's still got ears in him. But they're walking along the road. He's leaning on Rabbi Chaya's arm, and they come to a field. And Rabbi Yochanan says, that field used to belong to me, but I sold it so I could have money to live a life studying Torah. And they walk on further, and they come to an orchard. Rabbi Yochanan says, that orchard used to be mine, but I sold it so I could spend my life studying the Torah. They walked on further. They come to a vineyard. It's a beautiful vineyard. And Rabbi Yochanan says, and that vineyard used to be mine, but I sold it so I could have money to study the Torah. And at this, Rabbi Kaya breaks into tears. He says, what are you crying about? He says, you've sold everything. He says, what are you going to live on your old age? And all of a sudden, Rabbi Yochanan stands up straight and he says, do you think I'm wrong to sell what was given in 7 days to acquire what was given in 40? Do you understand what he's saying? How long did Moses stay on Mount Sinai receiving the Torah from God? 40 days. He only created the world 6 days. He created the whole world 6 days. He says, I sold what was made in 6 days so I could acquire what was made in 40. That's a good deal. Maybe Yeshua was aware of that, I don't know, when he made this parable. But you know, when you have this in mind about what pearls are, then Revelation 21 begins to make sense. It talks about the New Jerusalem, this cube, the city of God, the bride of Messiah. It says they had a great high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels. On the gates the names of the 12 tribes and sons of Israel were inscribed, and the 12 gates were 12 pearls. The gates into the city are pearls with the names of the 12 tribes over them. That's because you come into the city with wisdom or you don't come at all. You come into the city by knowing the Torah or not at all. Now, the courses of the wall have the names of the apostles. And we are saved by grace through faith. But our reward, our being part of that bride, is based on the fact that we are learning and growing and studying to show ourselves approved workmen who do not need to be ashamed. We're the wise virgins who are storing up the oil in our lamps, not the foolish ones that when the bridegroom comes, says, oh, can I have some of yours? No. Notice the wise virgins are called wise virgins, not stingy virgins. The wise virgins said no. I guess they weren't going to throw what was holy to those who don't recognize God's ownership. So we come into the city through wisdom. That wisdom was imparted through Israel. That's why their names are above the gates. Yes, Jim.
With the illegitimate son that knew Torah and was loved of God, does the true definition go further than just he knew Torah, or he applied it, or lived it?
All the above. A person who knows the Torah doesn't live it, doesn't know the Torah. He knows facts. I would say he knows the Torah the way the demons do. Okay? They know the Word of God, but they don't live it. Okay? And at least they tremble. How many of us tremble? So, knowing the Torah means you're living it out. And in this city, in the New Jerusalem, is a place where the Torah is lived, the eternal Torah of God. You enter it through the pearls. You know, I was wondering, why aren't there any pearls in the tabernacle? Did you read that, you know, this week and the weeks before, we've been reading through the Torah portions. It's all the description of the tabernacle, how it's built, its materials, and the materials of the high priest's garments. You see silver and gold and precious stones and all these other things. Where are the pearls? There are no pearls. Because the pearl represents something utterly spiritual. The tabernacle is physical. A pearl represents something utterly spiritual. And you know, I'm trying to think, pearls are mentioned throughout the Bible, but I can't think one place where a pearl actually makes an appearance. They're all talked about, but where is someone in the Bible actually had a pearl in their hand? I don't know. I don't know of any. Maybe there's one. Anyways, if you find it, let me know. It's like pearls are almost like they talk about them, but you never see one actually appear in the scriptures that somebody has, somebody does something with. I don't know. It's like the Torah itself is the pearl, and out of that comes the instructions for the tabernacle. So let's summarize. What is a dog? One who does not recognize God's ownership of itself or of things. We are to be people who know the holy from the unholy. We know it belongs to God, what he has ownership of, and we give to God what belongs to God. We recognize holy things. And we are not to take what is holy and give it to people who do not understand what holiness is. They don't understand God's ownership of something. How many times have you gotten into a frustrating conversation because you tried to give something holy to somebody who had no appreciation of it whatsoever? I know I've like beat my head against the wall and I realized this person simply has no appreciation for what belongs to God. A pig, on the other hand, is a person who does not recognize the spirit of truth. Now here's the thing that Yeshua says about the pig. Don't throw your pearls before the swine. Because the only thing swine are interested in are eating. It's eating. And when you put a pearl down there, I can't eat this. So it begins to walk forward. It crushes the pearl under its feet. And it thinks, well, I'll eat you. And when you try to give the spirit of truth to someone who does not recognize the spirit of truth, they will always go on the attack against you. The dogs don't. They appreciate the handout. But when you try to give something worth much, much, much more than meat, and you give to someone who does not recognize the spirit of truth, they will mock you, they will deride you, they will persecute you, they'll tear you to pieces. Mem, I see your hand up. Yes.
A person that recognizes that everything belongs to God, and we just in the light. And I love from way back a long time ago you mentioned about if a person see the light, they're not pigs, they're not dogs,
yeah.
But they come and they see, and we just take them and walk with them.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly what we do. We say, "Walk with me." And may I suggest that you don't start looking at people around you and say, oh, that she's a pig. Oh, that guy, he's a dog. No, we're not going to do that. What's that? Oh, yes. We were all, you know, these are self-portraits here, by the way. So, yes, I mean, let's not do this. But let's look at the spiritual essence of what Messiah is speaking to us. There are some people who simply don't recognize God's ownership of anything. And there are people who simply do not recognize the spirit of truth in anything. And Yeshua is simply telling us, don't take those things that are holy and those beautiful pearls of truth and throw them before people who have no appreciation of them. Give them to the people who do. All right? Otherwise, you're going to cause frustration, you're going to cause distance, and you can cause actually a lot of attack and persecution against yourself that you don't want. It's not beneficial. And this whole lesson, Yeshua says in one verse. This is not a major theme with Yeshua, but I think it's one of those verses we all read many, many times and just kind of glossed over. I thought, let's just take a look into it. But even this is not a major theme in the scriptures. Let's just make sure we understand that. And well, let's just be good stewards of the truth and the holy things God has given us. But most of all, let's give to God what he has redeemed, what he owns. Let's give it to him. Let's give it to him. And not invest it in things that don't matter. Okay? All right, let's one more. Yes, we'll give you the final word there, Steve. Yes.
Verse 17, the header on this paragraph, at least in the current, says the Lord's Supper.
Yeah.
It talks about when they get together and it says meetings and you're eating together. Then later on it goes and it talks about Yeshua with the bread.
Yeah.
How do you differentiate?
That's a great question. That's a great question. The question Steve is asking is back in 1 Corinthians 11, where they are. Paul's talking about when you come together and you're having banquets, having food and whatnot, and people come and don't eat it in a worthy way. They're just eating like gluttons. Well, actually, the answer is in our Siddur. On Friday nights, when we come together and we welcome the Sabbath, we take bread and wine. And we do a bracha, we do a blessing over them. And this is what we say. These are very, very ancient words. If I could just find them here quickly. And I should be coming up here soon. Okay. If you have a siddur, it's on page 25. And this is what we say. Blessed are you, Adonai, our God, King of the universe, who sanctified us with his commandments to pleasure in us, and his holy Sabbath in love and in pleasure he bequeathed to us. It's a memorial of the creation, a day which is the beginning of our sacred gatherings, and a memorial of our exodus from Egypt. For you chose us and sanctified us from all the peoples, and your holy Sabbath and love and pleasure you gave us. When Robin lights the candles on Friday night, she'll light the candle and say, these are to remember that God is our creator and our redeemer. Because in the liturgy for Friday night, this goes back thousands of years, they look at the Sabbath as a memorial that God is our creator and he's our redeemer, that he redeemed us out of Egypt. So that bread and that cup you take on Friday night is like a little mini Passover Seder before you have the whole meal. It's a memorial of Exodus from Egypt. For us as Messianic believers, we do this in remembrance of him as well. It's a memorial of the Exodus from sin and death that came to us through Yeshua. And so in Paul's day, in 1 Corinthians 11, the believers would come together to welcome the Sabbath on a Friday night. There'd be a huge meal, and they'd welcome the meal in with this little mini Passover Seder, with a bread, with a cup. It's a memorial of what Yeshua did for us on Passover. And then once a year, we have the big, full-blown Seder, the memorial of the Exodus from Egypt, a memorial of what Yeshua did for us. So again, it's not communion. It is Passover. But we even commemorate Passover on Friday nights. We welcome the Sabbath with this feast. And so that's what he's talking about. Yeah, he says, as often as you do this, well, how often do you do it? Once a week, Friday nights. So that's the background. I'm glad you asked that question. I'm sure other people would have had that as well. Okay? Now we have to close in prayer. So let's do so. Our Father and King, thank you so much for this time. Lord, I pray you'd help us to take that dog nature that each of us has in some area where we want to withhold from you the things that belong to you, the holy things. Lord, I pray we give you what belongs to you. And we would not be a thief. And Father, I pray that you would deliver us from that pig nature that is in each of us, about the things where, instead of pursuing the wisdom of your Torah, we'll pursue a TV show, a sportscast, or something else that's just a waste of time. But Father, I pray that we would seek the pearl of great price, that we come to know your truth, the essence and spirit of truth, to know your word, to live it out in our lives. And we would be the word made flesh, similar to the way that Yeshua is the word made flesh. That your word would be alive and seen in us in all that we say and do. So make us the people you want us to be, human beings, people who are fully alive to our God, who walk in the spirit and not in the flesh, and who feed upon the things that come from your lips. For it's from your lips, Father, that come the true pearls. So give us wisdom and understanding in regards to these things, and we'll give you the praise and the glory for all of it. In the name of Yeshua, our Savior, Messiah. Amen. Well, let's stand together, and I'm going to